Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The Obama administration defends a controversial prisoner swap with Afghanistan's Taliban movement. And Israel calls on world leaders not to recognize a new Palestinian unity government. I'm Michael Lippin, reporting from Washington. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is defending the Obama administration's decision to swap prisoners with Afghanistan's Taliban militant group without notifying U.S. lawmakers ahead of time. Hagel says U.S. officials believed that Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl was in danger and decided to act quickly to secure his release, rather than giving congressional leaders a 30-day notice of the prisoner exchange, as required by U.S. law. Under the deal, U.S. authorities released five senior Taliban detainees from a U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, on Saturday, and turned them over to Qatar, which has promised to hold them for 1 year. The Taliban handed over Bergdahl to U.S. special forces in eastern Afghanistan. Some opposition Republican lawmakers in Washington welcomed Bergdahl's release from 5 years in captivity, but criticized the terms of the prisoner swap. Republican Congressman Mike Rogers called the deal a fundamental shift in U.S. policy that would give terrorists a greater incentive to take Americans hostage. Hagel addressed that issue in remarks to reporters on Sunday, just before making a brief visit to Afghanistan.
Whether that could lead to possible new breakthroughs with the Taliban, I don't know. Hopefully, it might. But we pursued this effort specifically to get Sergeant Bergdahl back. As to another part of your question, could this embolden terrorists? Again, I remind you, this was a prisoner of war exchange. He was a prisoner.
Bergdahl was flown to a U.S. Army base in Germany on Sunday to undergo medical checkups. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is urging the international community not to recognize a Palestinian unity government that is expected to be unveiled on Monday. The unity government will bring together the secular Fatah faction of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank and the Hamas Islamist militant group based in Gaza. Robert Berger has more from Jerusalem.
Speaking at the weekly cabinet meeting in Jerusalem, Mr. Netanyahu said the world must not embrace this government. Hamas is a terrorist organization that seeks Israel's destruction, he said. Such a government would not bolster peace, Mr. Netanyahu said. It would strengthen terror. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas decided to end a 7-year rift with Hamas after peace talks with Israel collapsed a month ago. Hamas opposes peace negotiations and does not recognize Israel's right to exist. But Mr. Abbas says his peace policies will remain the official position of the government. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
In Hong Kong, hundreds of activists have held a march to protest the Chinese government's deadly crackdown on student protesters in Beijing's Tiananmen Square 25 years ago.
25 years on, the Tiananmen mothers, the victims' family of the Tiananmen massacre, never forgets the atrocity of the Chinese government.
The pro-democracy activists marched peacefully from Hong Kong's Victoria Park to the Hong Kong government headquarters. Organizers say they want the Chinese government to vindicate the 1989 student-led protest movement. A much bigger turnout is expected at an annual candlelight vigil in Victoria Park on Wednesday, the 25th anniversary of the June 4th Tiananmen crackdown. And Thai police shut down a major Bangkok shopping center on Sunday after people opposed to last month's military coup gathered there for an illegal protest. Thousands of customers at the Terminal 21 Mall on a major street intersection were forced to abandon early afternoon shopping as dozens of police moved inside the complex. Earlier, several protesters stood at the entrance to Terminal 21 holding anti-coup signs and chanting for freedom. I'm Michael Lippin.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. It's Sunday, June 1st, and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Thanks for joining us.
So far, it is evidently clear that a lot of effort is concentrated at making sure that these citizens of Nigeria, beloved citizens of Nigeria, are found and returned home safe and healthy and reunited with their country, witnessed with their death.
More than 200 Nigerian teenage schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram are still missing. What is the Nigerian government doing to rescue them?
There are indeed some links between terrorist groups as well as some of the criminal networks that are engaged in other types of criminal activity, whether it's narcotics trafficking or money laundering, what have you, who are also involved in the wildlife trade.
We take a look at the growing problem of poaching of Africa's wildlife.
The level of legal ignorance and access to legal services is too low.
And a Ugandan lawyer's attempt to help citizens navigate the legal system. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
Malawian President Peter Mutharika's inauguration ceremony will be held Monday at Kamuzu Stadium in Blantyre, just 2 days after he was sworn into office. After taking the oath of office Saturday, the new president said it will take the entire country to rebuild.
It's obvious that we're facing very serious problems in this country. No single person can do it. I want to invite all of us, government, opposition, the judiciary, the private sector, the press, members of the clergy, trade unions, all us together, collectively, we must try to rebuild this country.
But some supporters of President Mutharika say his credibility as a leader will depend on him making good on those campaign promises. Mr. Mutharika was swept into office by defeating incumbent president Joyce Banda. She had claimed the May 20th election was fraudulent, but the High Court overruled her request for another election after the main opposition party complained. Mr. Mutharika is the brother of late president Bingu wa Mutharika.
Sudan's foreign ministry says a Sudanese woman sentenced to death by hanging for identifying herself as a Christian will be freed within days following an international uproar over her conviction for apostasy. Ministry spokesman Abdullah Al-Azraq announced the development late Saturday in Khartoum. Word of 27-year-old Mariam Yahya Ibrahim's pending release comes days after she gave birth to her second child in prison while awaiting her execution. Ibrahim said she had never herself been a Muslim, despite Sudanese law defining children of Muslim fathers as Muslims by definition. Ibrahim is married to a Christian. A court in early May gave her 4 days to recant her Christian faith and impose the death penalty when she refused to do so. Sudan's 2005 constitution guarantees the right to freedom of worship, but in practice, the government enforces a form of Islamic law.
Meanwhile, the Nigerian militant Islamic group Boko Haram continues to hold more than 200 teenager schoolgirls it abducted from their dormitories one night in April. Michael Wery is the Director General of Nigeria's National Orientation Agency and Coordinator of National Information Center. He is in Washington and dropped by our studios, and I began by asking him about the progress on rescuing the abducted schoolgirls.
Well, a number of pronouncements have been made in this direction by the president as well as the various institutions responsible for the operations. And I still stick to the positions expressed. As you can see, I had the full action in line with the position of government and the, you know, commitment to adopting all possible best options is still there. So far, it is evidently clear that a lot of effort is concentrated at making sure that these citizens of Nigeria, beloved citizens of Nigeria, are found and returned home safe and healthy and reunited with their country, witnessed with their parents, continue to pursue their normal activities.
Is it your understanding so far that the government knows exactly where these girls might be?
Well, the Chief of Defence Staff had spoken about it. We stand by his position. He knows what he's saying.
It's the position of the Nigerian government not to negotiate with so-called terrorists. But to your knowledge, is there some negotiation going on to make sure that these guys are recovered in time?
You see, there are a number of options available to the government of Nigeria. The government of Nigeria has made it clear that it can dialogue with people, including these ones. And that was why it set up a committee long before Chibok to seek for partners to dialogue on issues of insecurity generally. And towards that direction, it has deployed some of the key influencers of opinion, respect to seek out these people. Mm-hmm. The position of the Nigerian government is clear about what it wants to do. That is to deploy all possible options, known now and unknown, that may be revealed either by action or from other further actions or discussions or strategies towards rescuing these children.
How helpful has the international community's help been? And are you able to make use of that help that you've gotten from the US, UK and other countries?
Yeah, all of it it's been quite helpful, because in the first instance, the international community, apart from their institutions, have risen in support of Nigeria towards finding these girls, which is commendable and further shows human solidarity in the quest to stamp out this kind of insurgency in the world. We appreciate it a lot. And some countries have gone even further to deploy men and materials, intelligence and facilities and capacity to assisting the Nigerian-led operations towards rescuing the girls and solving the issue of insurgency in Nigeria and the sub-region. So it's quite helpful.
Some people have criticized your government, the federal government, for lack of cooperation with the states. What's your comment on that?
No, you see, Nigeria, like America, is a federal system where the states have governors who have also structures of democracy embedded within the structure of government and governance. They have state legislatures, they have high courts, and the judiciary is properly established. The states have their own funds and funding. They have their own responsibilities in terms of providing infrastructure, school, water, health, and so forth and so on. The federal government has responsibility for specific services as established in the Nigerian Constitution. So it is clearly divided. There is a dividing line between what the federal government should do and what state government do. The president will not come and tell the governor of Borno State, for instance, to build schools in certain communities. The state governments have secondary schools, like the girls' secondary school in Chibok. It belongs to the state government. So there is no line of conflict, except where differences may exist as a result of belonging to different political parties. But in the execution and provision of services, the Constitution is clear about who should provide what.
Lastly, the Boko Haram issue has become more transnational across the region in the West Africa. How is the cooperation between your government and neighboring countries?
Well, you can see that as a result of concerted efforts, there was a meeting in Paris recently at the instance of the president with the support of the French government, where all the countries neighboring the area came together, not just marshal energies, intelligence and capacity, but to also share intelligence and cooperation towards making sure that the insurgency does not grow beyond where it is at the moment. And it is looking forward to even more and greater cooperation across Africa. And that is why the president of Nigeria also reached out to broader African countries. He had a meeting in South Africa recently to ensure that there is a synergy of action towards a coordinated response to this threat.
That was Mike Omeri, the Director General of Nigeria's National Orientation Agency and Coordinator of National Information Center. He spoke with us from our Washington studios.
As part of their year-long speaker series, the Africa-America Institute, AAI, will hold a panel discussion on Thursday to explore the role remittances play in Africa's economic growth. To find out more, I reached the president and CEO of AAI, Amini Kajunju, in New York.
Well, I think, you know, the economic realities on the continent are very challenging. And so we have situations where the diaspora is really subsidizing, you know, the consumption of the economic activities on the continent. Particularly, you know, it's basically middle class Africans here sending money to either individuals who are less fortunate on the continent within their families to help pay for tuition, for medical bills, for health, you know, issues. So I think just the economic realities on the continent can be very challenging for a lot of people.
What do you think African governments and private institutions can do to help reduce the cost of remittances?
Well, and that's one of the questions we're going to talk about, actually, because we're going to have a representative from an institution that is trying to bring the cost down. He's able to, you know, you're able to send money to Uganda, for example, at almost half the price of sending it through Western Union. This company doesn't have, you know, maybe the infrastructure that Western Union has, but, you know, so they're able to bring the cost down and still be reliable. So it's really a question of policy from the government. It's a question of more players entering the market and therefore reducing the price. And that's going to be a very determining factor. If we can get more people to compete with Western Union, then it's going to bring the price down a lot.
Critics say that because Africans in the diaspora are so focused on contributing to the economic development of the continent, they're somewhat lagging behind in achieving meaningful developmental goals in their adopted homes as compared to other migrant groups. How would you react to that?
That's a really interesting observation. I think that people in the diaspora, we're struggling, right? Because we need to fund consumption because people have needs that are very dire. People have school that they have to pay for, medical bills that have to be paid for. And so there are these sort of day-to-day immediate needs that many people in the diaspora pay for on the continent. But then, as your question stated, there are these major structural achievements that have to be made in order for economic development to truly occur. And how many of us are participating in those major structural, sustainable, long-lasting activities that's really going to change the African continent around? And that's the question that I think, that's the other thing that we want to discuss this time is, what can we be doing other than sending grandma $200 every month? Could we be investing in bonds, you know, and other instruments that's going to go towards building the continent, the infrastructure of the continent, the educational system of the continent, the health, you know, provisions on the continent? And so those are the things that we want to discuss at this event.
Amine Kajunju is the president and CEO of the Africa America Institute. She spoke with me from New York, New York.
Poaching of Africa's wildlife has become the realm of international crime syndicates that trade in diamonds, drugs, guns, and people. These global traders now buy elephant tusks and rhino horns from armed gangs that strike in any of the 50 protected areas of Africa. So who are these poachers? William Eagle reports on the politicals who is who that are killing Africa's wildlife.
Many of the armed militias in Africa kill elephants and rhinoceros to raise money for their civil wars, attempted coups, cross-border strikes, and overall survival in the bush. The heads of government outside the continent now agree with African leaders and wildlife conservationists that it's time to take action. 50 heads of state were invited to London in April to stop the $20 billion illegal trade in wildlife. Who are these armed bands of rebels turned poachers? A Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, Brooke Darby, offers a few names.
There are indeed some links between terrorist groups as well as some of the criminal networks that are engaged in other types of criminal activity, whether it's narcotics trafficking or money laundering, what have you, who are also involved in the wildlife trade. Al-Shabaab, the Lord's Resistance Army, the Janjaweed, those are among the entities that we believe are involved in wildlife trafficking in some way or another.
Many rebel forces plunder herds easily within their reach, such as the rhinos and elephants that share their refuge in the jungles of Virunga National Park. But Sudan's infamous Janjaweed travel greater distances to slaughter elephants in Mali, says Patrick Bergen, chief executive officer of the African Wildlife Federation and a member of the President's Wildlife Task Force Advisory Council.
The situation that I'm thinking about is in northern Cameroon in a park there. The Janjaweed people on horseback and with arms going over state borders, moving between different countries, basically just sweeping into a park area and slaughtering tens or hundreds of elephants and collecting the ivory and being gone again like the wind.
The Janjaweed raids on Buba and Jida National Park have been going on for years, but with less killing than in the past, Bergen said.
This happened in the last 6 months, and it's not something that could happen very many times because the elephant population simply wouldn't sustain it. The elephant population is not that large to begin with.
John Calvelli of the Wildlife Conservation Society lists a relative newcomer to the wars of Central Africa, the mostly Muslim Seleka Force, under the leadership of Michel Djotodia. They overthrew the Central African Republic's president, Francois Bozize, in Bangui, and held the country for about a year.
We've been working in CAR in Zangabai for over 20 years. One of our scientists has been embedded in that site monitoring this bay where literally hundreds of elephants come together. The Seleka Front was coming through this area, and our scientists had to be evacuated, and they killed over 26 elephants in the span of a couple of days. It would have been worse, but for the actions taken by the Gabonese government and others to help stop that.
A major wave of poaching has been moving across Africa from west to east and north to south, says Calvelli. Humanitarian groups that track evidence of genocide by armed militias have also seen those trends.
The Enough Project sent two researchers in to the Goama National Park in Congo to see how Joseph Kony, the Lord's Resistance Army, was funding its activities. They came back, and their studies from June 3rd of 2013, they came back and said one of the ways that we have to stop Joseph Kony is by making the sale of ivory illegal.
The State Department's Darby says there is a lot about the dynamics of wildlife trafficking that authorities do not know for certain. However, she says there is good evidence pointing to the identity of the poachers.
There is actually some evidence of military elements from some countries being involved in this trade. It's discussed a little bit in the report that was prepared by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Dealing with the corruption side of the house is also something that we are focused on.
A former U.S. Justice Department prosecutor of many wildlife cases, John Webb, says the battle against Africa's poachers will have to be fought by the continent's national governments.
The overarching impediment to effective enforcement against poaching and trafficking is corruption. And that is, you know, I'm going to make a bad joke here, but that's the elephant in the room.
Webb is also aware of the challenges for non-African governments. He's a member of the President's Advisory Council on Wildlife Trafficking with a long experience in interagency cooperation. It's not just a conflict between cops and criminals, he says. That's because, as Webb cautions, cops do not trust each other. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
The Wikimedia Foundation, the nonprofit that operates Wikimedia and its sister projects, has announced a strategic partnership with telecommunications services provider Airtel Nigeria to offer their consumers access to Wikimedia through their mobile phones free of data charges. VOA's Douglas Bernard talked to Caroline Schloeder, the Director of Mobile Partnerships at the Wikimedia Foundation, to find out more about this partnership.
The partnership is with Airtel in Nigeria, and it's part of a global initiative we have that's called Wikipedia Zero. We are partnering with mobile operators who waive the data charges to access Wikipedia sites, and it's just very important in markets where people have mobile phones. It's their only way to access the internet, yet they can't afford the data charges.
So basically, if I'm a Airtel customer in Nigeria, I can access Wikipedia and all that's on it free of charge.
Yes.
Is this unique to Nigeria, or are you planning either other similar ventures in other countries or even expand it out in Nigeria?
The program has been going for about 2 years now, and we're already in 28 countries with 30 operator partners, and we're looking to expand everywhere. You know, the Wikimedia Foundation wants to deliver knowledge freely to every person on the planet, and so Wikipedia Zero is an important part of that strategy.
And so I guess as of today, Wikipedia is available free for charge for anybody in Nigeria using Airtel.
That's exactly right, and we're excited because this is our first time launching Wikipedia Zero in Nigeria.
Well, it will be interesting to see not only how much traffic you get, but also how many contributors you get as well, because, you know, half of Wikipedia isn't just accessing it, but is contributing to it as well.
You're exactly right, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because when we talk about spreading knowledge, it has to be multi-directional. We want to increase the voices from other parts of the world on the Wikimedia sites. And so our hope is that by increasing readership and usage and really just awareness of Wikipedia, we'll engage more people into the community for contributions.
Caroline Schloeder, the Director of Mobile Partnerships at the Wikimedia Foundation. She spoke with VOA's Douglas Bernard.
Uganda has made headlines recently for controversial new legislation, but most Ugandans have little understanding of the laws and no access to legal counsel. To solve this problem, a Ugandan lawyer founded Barefoot Law, using social media and other technology to help people cut through the haze of misinformation surrounding the laws that govern them. Hilary Hula has more for VOA from Kampala.
Before he began law school, Gerald Abila says he had never actually seen a copy of his country's constitution. And he adds, he wasn't alone.
I travel a lot, and a lot of people in areas I travel were like me before I started studying the law. The level of legal ignorance and access to legal services is too low.
Ignorance of the law is no defense. But Abila says that given the level of legal access in Uganda, it's no wonder people know so little about it.
97% of lawyers in Uganda within the capital. So 97% of lawyers serve a population of 2 million people. And the remaining 3% is left to serve a population of around 36 million. So how do you overcome such challenges using technology?
Abila's answer is Barefoot Law, an organization he founded 2 years ago. Barefoot's team of volunteer lawyers uses Facebook, Twitter, SMS, Skype calls, and a 24-hour call-in service to answer any legal questions Ugandans have and to guide them through their cases. Everything they offer is free. This service has become especially pressing lately as Uganda passes a raft of controversial legislation, including a harsh new anti-homosexuality law, an anti-pornography law, and a bill criminalizing the intentional transmission of HIV. All that most people know of these laws is what they hear on the radio, says Abila, and the journalists often get it wrong. When the anti-pornography bill was signed, he says, most media reported that miniskirts were banned, and people started taking the law into their own hands.
There were instances of stripping women, and the women were fearing to then go and report to the police because they thought it was an offense to wear a miniskirt. So we wrote a post, and we advise the ladies, if you can identify anyone that has done that to you, they could be charged with indecent assault and a number of offenses.
The post, he says, was viewed 18,000 times by the end of the day. One Barefoot client, Latim Fassi, had spent all his money fighting for workers' compensation after a motorbike accident left him hospitalized for months. But no one would represent him. Barefoot Law, he says, are the only ones who would tell him his rights and explain to him how to proceed. In Uganda, he says, this is a rare thing indeed.
There are lawyers that even will call you at their own post, give you technical advices, call you to their offices, share with you breakfast on table while you discuss steps.
And the gratitude they get for their work is genuine. After helping two young people who had been kicked off their mother's land, Abila says, the Barefoot office received an unexpected gift.
The issue was resolved and the gentleman sent us shoes, some local shoes, and told us, hope you guys can now start wearing shoes and don't be barefoot anymore.
Those shoes, made of truck tires and string, are still hanging on the wall above his desk, a reminder of how far they still have to go. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And yet to come, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from African Collection.
And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
But let's kick off with Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at DMA. Good evening, Segun.
Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, June 1st. 8 teams have advanced to the second round of the qualifiers for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations to be hosted by Morocco. They are Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, Guinea-Bissau, Sierra Leone, Seychelles, Malawi and Mozambique. They advanced after the first round second leg matches played across the continent this weekend. The Harambee Stars of Kenya and the Mambas of Mozambique became the first teams to reach the next qualifying stage on Friday. Kenya drew 1-1 away with Comoros to advance 2-1 on aggregate, while Mozambique played goalless at South Sudan but progressed 5-0 on aggregate. Rwanda was the biggest winner on Saturday, upsetting Libya at home after playing goalless in the first leg in the North African country. The Amavubi Stars of Rwanda advanced 3-0 on aggregate. Uganda, hosting Madagascar in the return leg, won by a long goal to put aggregate score at 2-2. But the Cranes of Uganda progressed on the away goal rule. The Foxes of Guinea-Bissau, hosting the Wild Beasts of Central African Republic, won the second leg 3-1 to advance by the same aggregate scoreline. The Leon Stars of Sierra Leone pipped visiting Silangu Seminikati, or the King's Shield of Swaziland, 1-0 to advance 2-1 on aggregates. Malawi lost 3-1 away to Chad to leave aggregate score at 3-3. But the Flames of Malawi progressed on the away goal rule to the delight of new President Peter Mutharika, who was sworn into office on Saturday. Let's remind our listeners that Seychelles walked over Gambia to reach the second round after the Gambians were suspended from all CAF competitions for 2 years over age cheating. Six more qualifiers are due to emerge today, Sunday. All the 14 teams to reach the second round will play home and away matches in July and August, with the seven aggregate winners making it to the group stage, which is the last stage of the qualifiers. 21 teams have already drawn a bye into the group stage. Now to our weekly 2014 FIFA World Cup tidbits. It is now just 11 days to the kickoff of the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, and the countdown is winding down. Put your flags up in the sky, in the sky. And when we stand aside, stand aside. That's the official song of the 2014 FIFA World Cup, entitled We Are One. With just 1 week and 4 days to go, it is now clear that Brazil didn't do a very good job preparing for the tournament. There are still concerns about the country's readiness. Doubts remain about whether some stadiums will be fully ready. And it's already known that not all promised infrastructure work will be completed. Organizers will also have to worry about the widespread street protests that are expected during the tournament, with demonstrators already unhappy about corruption, poor public services, and the billions of dollars being spent to host the World Cup and the 2016 Olympics. Even though Brazil was awarded the World Cup in 2007, the local organizers are scrambling to complete all the necessary work. World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, acknowledged recently that it was, quote, a race, unquote, to make sure the country delivers everything it promised. We are very close now, FIFA Secretary General Jerome Volpe said, Soon we are going to hand the tournament over to the players and the 32 teams. There is very little to worry about. We just need to make sure the teams arrive safely and get to their training centers so they can begin preparing for the tournament. Construction work at stadiums is still underway, however, including the one hosting the opening match between Brazil and Croatia on June 12th in Sao Paulo. All six venues that were expected to be ready by the end of last year missed FIFA's deadline. The other six had already been used during the Confederations Cup last year, but four of those also were not ready when expected. Because the venues took so long to be ready, FIFA is now struggling to install the temporary structures that are crucial for the media, the sponsors, and technical teams. Back here in Africa, three of the five teams that are built to fly the African flag in Brazil were in action on Saturday as they prepare to name their final squad for the tournament on Monday, June 2nd, the FIFA deadline for all teams to submit their final 23-member squads. Algeria, Ghana, and Ivory Coast were engaged in friendlies, with Algeria the only one of the three teams to emerge victorious. The Desert Foxes of Algeria defeated Armenia 3-1 in their friendly in Switzerland. Defender Bekalem opened the score in the 14th minute before Gila scored the second goal in the 22nd and Slimani the third on the 41st minute. Armenia Atosakisov scored his team's only goal in the 46th minute. Algeria will play its second friendly on Wednesday against Romania at the Geneva Stadium also in Switzerland before heading for Brazil on Saturday, June 7th. In Brazil, Algeria will play at the group stage against Belgium, Russia and South Korea. In Rotterdam, hosts the Netherlands continued its build-up to the finals with a 1-0 win over fellow Brazil-bound Ghana. Manchester United striker Robin van Persie's 5th-minute goal proved decisive in the match. 2010 quarter-finalist Ghana was unable to produce any real chances against a stout Dutch defense, but looked in good shape ahead of their opening World Cup game against the United States on June 14th. The other teams in Ghana's group in Brazil are Germany and Portugal. And in the United States, Bosnia defeated Ivory Coast 2-1 in their warm-up in a match that Nigeria must have watched closely. Edin Dzeko scored twice for Bosnia, while Didier Drogba scored with a free kick on his 100th international. The Ivorians play El Salvador on Wednesday also in the United States, where they have been preparing over the last week for the tournament in Brazil. Ivory Coast will play Japan, Colombia, and Greece in Group C. Bosnia is in Nigeria's group at the World Cup. Earlier last week, two other Brazil-bound African teams, Cameroon and Nigeria, were in action. Cameroon's preparations for the World Cup took a knock when the Africans fell 2-1 to Paraguay in a pre-tournament friendly in Kostein, Austria, on Thursday. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at Africa Sports right here on Nightline Africa.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time for music from the continent. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Bye.
And that was a Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America.
Now to our commentary, One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN and Secretary General for Political Affairs. Here is Dr. Joner.
Good evening, Africa. If there were any doubts that in today's world the international system operates in a Kafkaesque manner, events and developments surrounding two elections in Malawi and Egypt would erase any such doubt. In the Malawi elections, there were many technical difficulties that threatened to adversely affect the results. But the presidential election were eagerly awaited, mainly because of the circumstances surrounding the transfer of power after the sudden death 2 years ago of President Bingu wa Mutharika. Attempts had been made then to prevent the legal vice president, Joyce Banda, who had fallen out with the president and had gone on to form her own party from taking over. At that time, the president's brother, Peter Mutharika, foreign minister, had been designated as the successor to his brother. But the machination to stop Joyce Banda failed, and she became Malawi's first female president. So this election was an opportunity to determine whether the people of Malawi would select her to continue in office or elect Peter Mutharika, who was also a candidate for the Democratic Progressive Party. It is worth recalling that prior to the death of President Binku wa Mutharika, he was at loggerheads with Western donors, and they had withheld their economic assistance. They had, however, welcomed his successor, President Joyce Banda, with open arms. Unfortunately for President Banda, her administration had been widely accused of much corruption, that she made a colossal mistake that was a problem. During the voting process, she had decided to declare the elections null and void. Fortunately, the High Court stepped in to reject her decision on the grounds that she had no constitutional authority to do so. This would have been a most unfortunate development in Africa for a sitting president to declare elections null and void. In fact, from now on, it should be agreed that no president should be allowed to decide the elections whether it's null and void, because this will be another method for presidents to remain in power. Joyce Banda had said the 90-day extension for election would not allow her to continue as a candidate, but this would not have mattered. The next stage of the confusion in the elections in Malawi was the matter of recount. Most of the opposition parties wanted a recount because of allegations of rigging and fraud. While the Malawi Electoral Commission was willing to begin recount, Peter Mutharika's party went to court to stop it on the grounds that recounts can be done only after the results had been announced. The argument regarding recount continued to the legal date for the declaration of results last Friday. The Electoral Commission would not announce the results until the court decide on its proposal that it should be given an additional 30 days to do recount before announcing the results. Very late in the day, the High Court rejected the proposal and ordered the commission to announce the results. In the circumstances, Peter Mutharika was declared by the commission as the elected president of Malawi. And within 24 hours, he was hastily sworn in as president, perhaps to prevent President Banda staying a single hour in office. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thank you for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And join us again on Saturday. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the second half of the 20th century and into the third millennium, advocacy for democracy and respect for human rights have been central components of U.S. foreign policy. That's because not only does our support of democracy promote such fundamental American values as religious freedom and worker rights, but also because acting on behalf of human dignity is in our national interests, said President Barack Obama during a major policy speech at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, New York.
America's support for democracy and human rights goes beyond idealism. It is a matter of national security. Democracies are our closest friends and are far less likely to go to war. Economies based on free and open markets perform better and become markets for our goods. Respect for human rights is an antidote to instability and the grievances that fuel violence and terror.
Even though too many governments are still cracking down on civil society and are ever more tightly abridging their citizens' rights to freedom of speech and of peaceful assembly, more people live under elected governments today than at any time in human history, said President Obama. Even the upheaval of the Arab world reflects the rejection of an authoritarian order that was anything but stable, and now offers the long-term prospect of more responsive and effective governance, he said.
You know, ultimately, global leadership requires us to see the world as it is, with all its danger and uncertainty. We have to be prepared for the worst, prepared for every contingency. But American leadership also requires us to see the world as it should be, a place where the aspirations of individual human beings really matters, where hopes and not just fears govern, where the truths written into our founding documents can steer the currents of history in a direction of justice.
The question we face, said President Obama, is not whether America will lead, but how we will lead, not just to secure our peace and prosperity, but also extend peace and prosperity around the globe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.